I wanted to say a word or two at the very beginning before I introduce the two speakers who'll do the real meat of this session. When we, and by we I mean, of course, the class of 58, of which not all of you are that, but okay. But when we arrived at Amherst in September of 54, one of the windows that opened to us, lots of windows were opening, but one of the windows that opened to us was Science 1-2, the bane of existence for some people and the most glorious thing we had come across for others. Science 1-2, in which Charlie Cole, the president, and Arnie Ahrens, the professor, felt that they would be not living up to their responsibility if they didn't provide us with a sound and a quantitative introduction to the new fields of atomic and nuclear physics, which they saw as being that would be such a dominant role in the world that we would graduate into in 1958. This morning, therefore, I thought that it would be fascinating. Now, that's history, of course. It would be fascinating to look into a couple of the newly opening fields, fields which the faculty of 2018 could feel similarly responsible for providing that same kind of sound and in quantitative introduction to the freshmen of the Amherst freshmen and women of 2018. First speaker today is going to be Kate Follett. Kate is an undergraduate up the road in snowy Middlebury, and where she majored in physics and in Japanese studies. When she was done up there, she in fact then went to the University of Arizona to a much warmer and sunnier clime, and got her PhD in astrophysics in 2014. 4 years later, she is continuing to focus on the search for extraterrestrial life and for the hunting for exoplanets, planets around other stars other than our sun, planets in our own galaxy, but way, way, way far away, with perhaps quite different life forms than we have here. These are, in fact, and she's also working on the technology which is involved with the being able to take direct images of these exoplanets as they orbit their own stars. Where she's working is a whole new field, which were invisible to us when we arrived here at Amherst, way below the horizon, things that hadn't even been talked about or thought about even, it's in 1954, but in fact now are at the horizon and getting above the horizon in 2018. At Amherst this fall, she will be teaching a course in intro astronomy, as well as a course in alien worlds. And so you can see the sort of the whole different tone. We would never have used those tones in 1954. Anyway, my pleasure to introduce Kate, and she will have the first session. Good. Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, that'd be great. Thanks. Thanks, Peter, and thanks for having me. I guess the first thing that I'd like to stress, so I'm going to start with a little bit of historical perspective, but the first thing I'd like to mention is that exoplanets, even when I was a child, were still science fiction. So this is a very, very new field and an exciting one. So if I had told anyone when I was a kid that I wanted to grow up and study planets around other stars, even a physicist, I think, or an astronomer would have told me I was crazy. So I want to start with a little bit of historical perspective, and I'm going to use this plot. And so I just want to walk through it briefly to start. So this is a plot of the mass of planets in Earth masses. So 10 to the 0 here is a 1, or 1 Earth mass. And then the period in years is on this axis. So 10 to the 0 here again is 1 year, 10 years, 100 years. So it's a logarithmic scale. And logarithmic scales are important when we want to show a range of things that have a very that occupy what we call a very wide range of parameter space. So things that have a wide range of separations and masses are good for logarithmic plots. Over here, so I'm going to advance this forward. Over here, we have a year and a count of exoplanets. So in the year 1750, what were the six planets that we knew?
Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Earth, Saturn, Venus,
Mercury, and Earth, right? So the six planets that we knew of were the five naked eye planets in our solar system plus Earth, right? And you can tie those, so here's a, so at 10 to the zero years and 10 to the zero Earth masses, this is Earth, of course, Venus, Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, okay? So in 1750, there were only six planets that we knew of. I just translated this to distance from the star. So as you may have learned in that first course, although if it were nuclear physics, maybe you didn't, there's a direct translation between the period of a planet's orbit and its distance from its star semi-major axis. So these are units relative to Earth. So one astronomical unit is one Earth-Sun distance. So those are the planets that you identified. So the next advancement in planetary science came in 1785 when William Herschel discovered Uranus. Then in 1850, a couple of a mathematician named Le Verrier predicted the location of Neptune based on perturbations in the orbit of Uranus. So I always tell my students math is useful for something. So we predicted the location of Neptune, and an astronomer with a telescope looked in the spot that was predicted by the mathematician, and there you go, Neptune was there. The history of the discovery of Pluto is a long story, and actually people tried to discover it based on orbits, perturbations in the orbit of Neptune, but it turned out there was just some problems with the observations, so there aren't really significant perturbations in the orbit of Neptune due to a large external planet. But Clyde Tombaugh did eventually find Pluto in 1930, and I like to include Pluto in the story still, even though I don't think it's a planet. I'm sorry. because it is the only planet that was discovered by an American, so... It's what? Yep, it's off the bottom of the scale. Oh, yeah, I just animated an actual picture of Pluto in there. So from that period forward, from 1930 forward, there are no advancements in our knowledge of how many planets there are around other stars until 1995. So if you think about in 1994, before this next planet was found, the word exoplanet didn't really exist yet. But what do you think people thought of when you said planet around another star? Anyone? Science fiction, yeah, exactly. Okay, so here are some examples of science fiction of the 1970s and 80s, even as far back as 1950. And what I'd like to stress about these is there's a real lack of creativity here. Do any of you notice anything about this? They all look like Earth, or I'm pretty sure this is actually Mars with the Starship Enterprise photoshopped into the foreground, right? So we imagined very solar system-like planets, right? It's not crazy. It's the only data point that we had. The kind of most creative we got was this vision of Tatooine, one of the Star Wars worlds that Luke Skywalker visits, where you have two suns. By the way, there really are planets that orbit binary star systems, so we've found some like this. But that's about as creative as we got. So I'm going to jump all the way forward to where we are today after I show you this one. So first of all, this is 51 Peg B, which was discovered in 1995, and you can see that even with the discovery of the first of these extrasolar planets, it occupies an entirely different region of this plot, and kind of a puzzling one that I'll talk about in a moment. Here's where we are today. So here are our solar system planets. Now this is a plot that I made. I actually haven't updated it in about 6 months, so there are a handful of more planets that we could include here. So we have four different colors of points here, and those are four different methods that we now use to discover planets around other stars. Each one has its own biases and preferences for the kinds of planets that we can discover. But there are a few things that I'd like to point out about this. So I'm curious about your impressions, though. First, what's the, you know, what do you notice when I show you this? Is there anything surprising or interesting about it? There, a lot of them are smaller than the planets in our solar system. So in terms of mass, right, so there's a lot that are smaller than Jupiter. And there are a lot that are farther in than Mercury in our solar system. Radial velocity has discovered a lot of them. So radial velocity is also called the Doppler wobble technique. So what you're discovering is actually you're observing the star that the planet orbits, and you're seeing it being tugged towards and away from you a little bit. So the light from the star is actually shifted red and blue a little bit due to the gravitational influence of the planet. But that's a very successful method, radial velocity. Yeah. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. Imaging doesn't get you lucky.
Oh, okay, I'm an imager, and I don't disagree with you, okay, but this is where I work, and I will try and convince you by the end of this talk that these are actually the most interesting and important ones. I'm completely unbiased. I'm completely unbiased, but yes, okay. Yeah? Yeah, so I made a log plot, but I think I cut off one over here. Yeah. So there are a couple things I wanted you guys to take away from this. So the first one is kind of interesting. So a lot of people look at this plot and they say, whoa, the solar system's really weird, right? Because it's way off of the edge of the plot down here, all these solar system planets. But that's actually a selection bias. So we're working at the very hairy edge of all of these technologies, and none of them are really fully capable of detecting solar system analogs regularly yet. So we have a population of planets that we're filling in here. I'll tell you, my personal view is that never in the history of astronomy has the Earth proven to be special. So it's extremely unlikely that there aren't tons of planets down here in systems that look a lot like our solar system. So that's kind of one thing that I wanted to point out about what's so exciting about all of these technologies is that we're pushing them all out. Well, direct imaging we're pushing in, but all the other ones we're pushing out to larger semi-major axes, and we're pushing them all down to lower masses. So in the next couple decades, I think we'll fill in a lot of this part of parameter space. So one thing you might notice is there's a cloud of things that Jupiter's just at the edge of. And this is probably kind of a real clustering of planets approximately akin to Jupiter. So Jupiter is probably one of this family of planets that are right here. So that's the first thing I wanted you to take away. Mm-hmm. But you can. So it's also called direct imaging, and I'll tell you exactly how it works in a few minutes, but good question. It does seem crazy that you would be able to see them directly. So the other thing I wanted to point out about this is that there are three populations of planets here that are really weird, that we never really imagined could exist. So 51 Peg B, as you may recall, was in this sort of region of the plot, and these are all planets that are closer to their star than Mercury, and Jupiter mass or larger in some cases. So astronomers aren't very creative. We call them hot Jupiters. Okay. The second ones, and these are perhaps the most interesting, even though I work up here, are planets between the size of the Earth and Venus and Uranus and Neptune. So in our solar system, there's a big, big difference in the composition, in the nature of the planets, the terrestrial planets here, and the gas giants. These are sometimes called ice giants, sometimes given a second category. But there's a whole population of planets that exist in between here. So actually, we can't decide what to call them. We call them super-Earths, but some people call them mini-Neptunes. And probably in that large difference between them, there are actually two populations. There are some larger rocky planets that look like Earth, and there are some scaled-down versions of Neptune. So hot Jupiters. These are what I call the distant super Jupiters, and I will explain to you why they're interesting. But they're very far away from their stars, in fact, far enough away that sometimes we have trouble explaining how they got there. And they're very massive. So we are kind of just now getting, with this technology, to being able to detect Jupiter masses. And then super-Earths. So the sort of last thing I wanted to point out is that there's sort of a region of overlap that proves to be very interesting. So these green points and the blue points are overlapping quite a bit. So the radial velocity method I mentioned, it's based on the tug of the planet or of the around the star. So that determines, so what you can get from that observation is the mass of the planet. The transit method, I don't know if any of you saw the transit of Venus in 2012, but it's essentially the planet passing in front of the star and blocking some of the light behind it. And from that observation, you get the size. So if you have a size and you have a mass, you have a density, which is very interesting for characterization in that you can tell something about the bulk composition of the planet. We're also similarly getting into a regime where we'll be able to see the same planets with radial velocity and imaging, which is also very interesting. I can talk more about that. So let me talk about what I do, which is direct imaging. I often give talks that are almost entirely justifying the existence of my field. Okay? Because when I show people that plot, of course, the planets that we detect are the least interesting, and we have the smallest number of them, right? So why is direct imaging the technology of the future? And I very much think it is. And I'm not alone in this either. I'll tell you about that. First of all, the first reason that it's great is what I'd call visceral satisfaction, okay? Because all of the other exoplanet detection methods are indirect. You're observing the star. You're inferring the existence of the planet based on the behavior of the star. Direct imaging, in direct imaging, we can actually isolate the light from the planets themselves. So it's hard to argue that these aren't real things that you're seeing in these. So I put an arrow to show you where they are in these images. So in each of these, the star is at the center of the image, and it's been covered up. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, but we're directly isolating light from the planets themselves. So that's cool, visceral satisfaction. It's hard to do, as you can maybe imagine. So I like to draw this parallel to something that you can understand in the real world. So the contrast, or the ratio in brightness between the star and a planet, so between the Sun and Jupiter, is something like, so it's a contrast of a billion, so Jupiter is a billion times fainter than the Sun, is approximately like if you took a cluster of 10 bioluminescent algae and you put it next to a lighthouse, that's the difference in brightness. And I'll tell you, we can't actually do that yet. We can't detect things that are a billion times fainter than their stars. What we can do is image hot, young exo-Jupiters. So recently formed analogs to Jupiter that are still glowing in infrared light. So you could think of it as leftover heat from the formation process. And those have a contrast of only a million times fainter than the star. And lest you think that that's easy, that's equivalent to imaging a firefly next to a lighthouse. So we obviously have to play some tricks to make that happen. So the one that we use primarily to overcome this contrast obstacle is called coronagraphy. And you've all experienced this if you've tried to see a plane in the sky flying near the sun. Your first instinct is always to cover up the sun with your hand, right? So you can see the things next to it. Coronagraphy is much like that. We block the light from the star. So here's an example that I just really like of a picture from the Cassini spacecraft where they're essentially using the planet Saturn as a coronagraph to cover up the sun, and that little speck there is Earth. We, of course, use somewhat more sophisticated coronagraph. Well, I don't know. Saturn's a very sophisticated coronagraph, but not a practical one, so we build them into our instruments. The angular separation piece is the other thing that's hard because, of course, when the planet and star are very, very far away, they appear very close together on the sky. So you have to overcome an obstacle of angular separation as well. So I made this slide when I was living in California, and I haven't updated it, but here's the basic analog. So it's like me calling up my dad in Minneapolis, 1,500 miles away, and saying, "Dad, get out your telescope, look at the lighthouse at Santa Cruz. Do you see the firefly flying 20 feet above it?" So we're talking about 1/10,000th of a degree that we have to be able to separate. So how do we do that? We use a technology called adaptive optics. Adaptive optics has been used to study this region of the galactic center. This is a brief aside, not my field, to observe the stars at the galactic center orbiting around this star has been animated in something that doesn't emit any light, the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And because we understand gravity fairly well, these are orbiting on very nice Keplerian orbits. We can estimate the mass of the object that they're orbiting, and it's many millions of times the mass of the sun. So the evidence for the existence of a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy comes from adaptive optics. This is an image of the human retina taken with adaptive optics. So ophthalmologists who want to study the retina in detail, because the retina is swimming in ocular fluid in the back of your eye, it turns out to be very difficult to resolve it at very high resolution. So they use adaptive optics to see things like blood flow and individual cones in the eye. And here's how adaptive optics works for a telescope. So the great irony of imaging things from the ground of the Earth is that things take many millions of years, light takes many millions of years to reach us, or tens of years, even hundreds of thousands of years, a whole range of time to get to us. And in the last millisecond of its journey to the telescope, what was what we call a perfectly flat wavefront, so a perfectly unaberrated image of the star, gets completely distorted by the Earth's atmosphere. So the turbulent patches in the Earth's atmosphere, the way that I think about them, or the way that astronomers think about them, is there's a sort of characteristic size called the coherence length. So you could think of that as the size of a patch in the atmosphere across which a light wave will be locally flat. So you can see within each of these patches, it's locally flat, but you could think of each one maybe as kind of like a lens that's bending the light in one direction or another. So what you end up out with after you pass through the turbulent layer of the atmosphere is a corrugated wavefront. So, and that means a blurry image. So what are you going to do with that? Well, if you can put magnetic actuators on the back of your telescope and deform the surface to correspond to that same corrugation, then when the light bounces off of it, it'll be locally flat. It'll be flat again. So that's how adaptive optics works. And it allows us to take images like this. So, you know, I often feel a little sad competing with people who do, like, planetary science and have beautiful images to show people, or people who study galaxies with Hubble and have lovely, lovely images. This is a beautiful image, even though it doesn't look like it, okay? It's scientifically beautiful because that is the light from a planet around this star, 51 Aries B. So this is a group that I worked with as a postdoc and still work with today. We actually have an observing station down the hall here to observe on Gemini in Chile. But this planet here is the lowest mass, closest in planet that we've discovered with direct imaging to date. So we're at the point of discovering things that are a couple of Jupiter masses and sort of approximately Neptune-ish distances. So we're moving in the right direction with this technology. So I mentioned the visceral satisfaction advantage, but there's a more important scientific advantage to direct imaging over all the other exoplanet detection methods, and that's the advantage of what I'd call characterization. So because we isolate the light from a star directly, we can spread it into its component colors and characterize its atmosphere. So direct imaging is really the only of, well, There's a slight caveat, but the only of the detection methods that's capable of characterizing planets that we find, and that's why it's the technology of the future. So here's an actual spectrum of a of an exoplanet. And what you'll see here is that there's a lot of shape to this. And for example, in this range that's labeled H, the reason it has this peak here is because on either side of the peak, methane in the atmosphere of the planet absorbs light and doesn't let it escape from the planet. So we know that there is methane in the atmosphere of this planet. It's methane dominated, much like Jupiter. So I'll talk in a few minutes about how, so we can tell things like temperature, we can tell a little bit about composition, things like metallicity. I'll skip that for now. So here's just walking through. So the kinds of imagers that we're building today actually take more than one picture of the planet at once. So getting one picture of a planet that's a million times fainter than its star seems almost impossible, but actually we're taking 30 of them at once or so. So we're walking through the images on the left here, and this is the spectrum on the right. So you can see you don't see much at the location of the planet in certain wavelengths. And then when you reach this sort of gap between the two methane absorption bands, it suddenly gets very bright and then dim again. So that's what the actual data looks like. So where are we going with this? By the way, that planet right there, that's 51 Aries B. So almost like Jupiter. Here's where we're going, and this is why this is important. Does anyone know what image this is? Another image that doesn't get enough credit for being really, truly beautiful. Anyone recognize it? This is the Earth. This is the pale blue dot. So Carl Sagan classically convinced the Voyager spacecraft team to point the telescope back at Earth from beyond the orbit of Neptune. And that is the Earth suspended in a glint from the spacecraft. That's not like a real thing. So this is what we're working towards. Of course, I think super Jupiters are interesting and important. Are they why I got into this field? No. We would like to be able to detect Earth-like planets with this technology because, of course, that characterization advantage then becomes very powerful. So here's where we are today. We're imaging things that are the star is a million times brighter than their planet, and separated by 1/10,000th of a degree. With some future telescopes, we should be able to, hypothetically, get to exo-Earths, so pale blue dots. And in this case, it's 10 billion times brighter. The star is 10 billion times brighter than the planet, and we have to get into even tighter separations. If we can do that, so by the way, this is a simulated image. So the way to do that is to apply these technologies in space, to apply adaptive optics and coronagraphy to space telescopes, such as this one, which is being considered for the 2020 Decadal Survey in Astronomy, LUVOIR. If you, for a large space telescope, apply these technologies, you can conceivably get to something like this. So this is actually a simulation of what people think, so a very optimistic, I'll say, view of what you might see if you put our solar system at about 10 parsecs away, so about 30 light years away, and imaged it with LUVOIR. You would easily get Jupiter, relatively reliably see Earth, maybe even Venus. Is what they're predicting with this. I'll say it's a teensy bit optimistic, but we'll be moving in that direction. And the reason this is interesting, so here is a high-resolution spectrum of the Earth's atmosphere. So kind of like the one I showed you of 51 Aries B, which looks like Jupiter's atmosphere, this is what the Earth's atmosphere looks like. And there are various things in here that people attribute to the presence of life on the planet. So things that are not in equilibrium, like ozone. Water vapor you can create in sort of dead planet atmospheres, but most dead planets have carbon dioxide dominated atmospheres. Their spectra look somewhat more simple. So at least some of these point to geologic or atmospheric activity. People often debate what biosignatures would be, which ones are unambiguous biosignatures. There are often molecules in the atmosphere that can be created by both biological processes and geological processes. So this is still very much an open area. But what I find really exciting is that this is conceivably what we could do in the not too distant future. So of course, we're not going to get a spectrum that's this beautiful. We have pretty much unlimited light from the Earth when we want to take a spectrum of it from an orbiting spacecraft. We will have very limited light, but we'll be able to see some of these major features in the atmosphere. Here's the ozone one. These are water bands, etc. In, you know, a fairly modest sort of investment of time with one of these future space telescopes. HABEX and LOUVOIR are two of the missions that are being considered for the 2020 Decadal Survey in Astronomy. So this is a very exciting place to be. I hope that I've convinced you. And really, just to drive the point home a little bit, the only way we will ever get things like this of an Earth-like planet, the only way we'll ever characterize an exo-Earth, is using this technology of direct imaging. So, of course, we are all working very hard to try and push the technology to the point where we'll be able to do that. And in the meantime, we're discovering some super Jupiters, which are cool, too. So, sort of the last thing, I'll just go back to my analogy here and say that an exo-Earth at a contrast of 10 billion is the same as one bioluminescent algae, ELGA. I had to look up what the singular of algae is, because when do you ever use that relative to a lighthouse? So I hope to be able to tell you about something like that in the next, at your reunion 10 years from now. Thank you. Oh, with the pale blue dot? It's a glint off of the spacecraft, just kind of coincidentally. It makes the picture a little more interesting to look at, so that's nice.
Yes. Are any of those new next-generation direct imaging space telescopes being built yet?
Yes, one of them, called WFIRST, AFTA. That one will have a coronagraphic instrument on it that is a technology demonstration. So they want to try and prove that adaptive optics and coronagraphy can work in space. So that's kind of one step on the way. The other ones are being considered for the 2020 Decadal Survey, which means they're probably at least 20 years past that. So by 2040, they might be in space. Yeah, the TMT. So the large ground-based telescopes, so like the 30-meter class telescopes, the largest telescopes we have now are 10-meter class. 30-meter class telescopes will do really exciting things in exoplanets. Right now, there's not a... there aren't a lot of... In our field, they won't do... Like, it won't be a revolution, but it will certainly be... It will allow us to do things we can't do now. It won't be the same revolution that that launching these things in space will be. But to answer your other question, most of our data are taken from a telescope in Chile called Gemini, and I do most of my work in Chile. But we are moving our instrument to Mauna Kea, so we'll get to spend more time in Hawaii in the near future.
Can I move your observatory, or can you move the hotel?
We're moving just the instrument. So it attaches to the bottom of the telescope.
Yeah. The chart that showed the different ways that the planets were found, I kept wondering why you put the chart that way. I mean, does the way that they were found imply the size?
Oh, you mean why is this mass? Because, good question, because each one has its own unique biases. And it really, this plot drives it home. So for example, why does direct imaging occupy this part of parameter space? Because it's hard to see faint things, and it's hard to see them close, right? Whereas actually radial velocity and transits, the probability of detecting a signal from a planet via either of those methods is much higher close to the star, and again, higher mass. So each one has its own biases, is the, yeah.
Are there any new techniques on the horizon? In other words, you've got four of them right now. Your fifth one that people are thinking about?
Excellent question. There is. So some of you may have heard about the Gaia spacecraft, which is, it sounds super boring, but it's actually really interesting. It's just looking at a large, looking at all the stars in the sky and trying to see them moving relative to, so the Earth's orbit around the sun causes an effect called parallax, which makes things that are closer move a little farther back and forth over the course of the Earth's orbit than things that are farther away. So Gaia is very precisely determining the positions of all these planets in the sky and watching them move via parallax, watching them move through the galaxy. And we think that if you can do that very precisely, you should be able to detect planets via a method called astrometry, where actually you see the star. It's another indirect method, but a pretty cool one. You actually see the star physically move. Not wobble in and out like the radial velocity method, but kind of move around a little bit due to the influence of the planet. And so far we haven't had any detections, but we're all waiting. The Gaia team is sitting on some of their data, which we think means that they have some promising candidates.
Yep.
So the geometric probability of seeing a transit is based on the inclination of the system and how close the planet is. So that's exactly why transits are biased towards seeing things that are very close to the star, because there's like a little more wiggle room in the inclination of the system for detecting it. But you're right. If we see all of these, that means that there are an equal number in systems that aren't inclined with the corrupt.
Planets in the galaxy, and there are stars when we begin to add them all up.
Yeah.
And that's because there are several planets around and lots of stars, and most stars do seem to have planets. Well, I think this is a
thank you.
It's very exciting to think about the things which Kate and her students are going to see over the next several decades. This is where science from 2018 goes forward from there. The next person, speaker is Richard Goldsby. Richard got his PhD from UC Berkeley in 1961, when we were just starting out in those sort of directions. In the early 80s, we lured him away from the University of Maryland, and for the last three decades, he's been teaching here at Amherst. He has been promoted into the status of Professor Emeritus just recently. He is an immunologist and a renowned expert in the human genome, things that we wouldn't have even thought about thinking having him. And in immunotherapy, something which I think a number of us are going to become very interested in. These are other whole fields, hullabaloo fields, which in 1954 were well below, they were invisible, well below the horizon of the things that we could think of studying, and which are now back up into the world where you can study them and talk to us. So anyway, Dick Bowlesby.
Of you who were taking science at Amherst College back in 1963 cancer was very much a mystery at that time. Certainly all the answers aren't in place now. And some of you are physicians and you came into this room with an understanding of cancer. If I do my job correctly, all of you are going to leave this room with some understanding of what the nature of primary cancer is, a level of understanding that if you had walked into a meeting of the most distinguished oncologists in the world in 1963 and told them what I hope you know in another 15 minutes, they would have been astonished at the insights you would have brought them. That's how far, that's how deeply the knowledge and the understanding has progressed. There is a great deal more to learn, particularly about how cancers manage to metastasize successfully from one place to another. Now, if you look at the natural history of cancer, what happens is it starts small, in fact, with just one cell. And then over the course of a long, long time, quite typically, the cancers physicians treat in hospitals, that cancer has been growing in the patient for 15 years, 20 years, maybe 30 years. Bert Vogelstein, one of the most distinguished oncologists in the world, says when he sees his patients with colorectal cancer, they've usually had it for about 35 or 40 years. So it goes along, and finally it reaches a stage where it might be visible on an X-ray. Then it gets a little bigger, and if you're if it's in a conspicuous place, you might feel it and want to ignore it. And then it gets to a point where even the patient will diagnose their own cancers, and they come in and they get diagnosed. The shame about cancer is that it doesn't hurt when it's little. If it hurt when it was small and told you where it was, there'd be a much better chance of interdicting it and a much higher cure rate. But we live with the world and the universe as it is. Now, the deepest insights in the nature of cancer came from the study of a virus that infects not us, but chickens, something called the Rous sarcoma virus. When people looked at the Rous sarcoma virus, they found a series of genes, gag, pol, and envelope, that were very important for building the virus itself. But there was another gene there, a gene called SARC, and nobody really understood what that gene was for. When researchers looked around to see where they could find it, they looked at other tumor viruses, they found it in some, and then just as a control, because you always want to have a biological system that lacks a particular effect you're looking at, so you can have some way of judging the actual biological effect that you're interested in. Well, when they looked at normal cells, cells that were not cancer cells, what they found was that you had this SARC gene present in those normal cells. And that was the kind of thing you call a mistake, so you do it again and again, and it was persistent. It was Harold Varmus and Bishop. Harold Varmus was a student here at Amherst College. It was Varmus and Bishop's idea that gave the deepest and most guiding insight that cancer has. And that idea is that the genes that cause cancer, or that cancer is caused by a transformation in a normal gene, a gene that's absolutely essential for the normal growth of a cell, when that gene undergoes a change, usually a mutation, what happens is you get a gene that gives persistent growth signals, and that cell grows without limit. So you get genes that are proto-oncogenes, normal genes you've got to have to function. That gene undergoes a genetic change, becomes a gene that gives that signal all the time, giving a persistent growth signal to the cell. And so if that goes on and more of them take place, you get a condition called cancer. Varmus, of course, got a Nobel Prize for that. That idea, the idea of the oncogene, is the animating principle behind cancer and the animating principle behind much of cancer research and understanding cancer today. Now, usually, almost always, it's not just one genetic change that takes place. But if you model it mathematically, if you just needed one change, what you would find is, and if that was a random change, with the passage of time, it would increase linearly. You'd get a 45-degree line, one of those lines at Aaron's, I'm sure, had you deduce quite regularly in your course. You'd get a 45-degree line. You don't. What you get is one of these hyperbolic lines, like so at the bottom, that says several events, several random events have to take place. People have estimated usually it's between 4 and 6. Those are mutations that underlie the development and the origin of a true cancerous state. When you've had those number of genetic accidents take place, you have full-blown cancer. And it's modeled in this second panel over here, where you start with a cell that has an initiating mutation. Perhaps you develop that first oncogene, and those cells grow a little more rapidly than the ones there, but it's not cancer yet. They're still under a number of regulatory controls. You get subsequent mutations that take place, more mutations, and more of those mutations take place to the extent where now the cell has slipped the barriers imposed by normal growth controls, and that cell becomes an autonomous unit that ignores the normal signals that would regulate and control its growth and grows uncontrollably and left to itself will be decisive in how we leave this life. Now, how do we know that cancers undergo mutations in real life, not just in classes and so forth, and in theory? How do we know it? We know it because now it's possible to get whole genome sequences and to get them at a cost that's low enough that allows one to look at a large number. Around the country and around the world, people have determined a large number of total sequences of cancer genomes, and they know that mutations take place. And the way you do that is you take a normal cell in a patient, and you sequence those normal cells, and you take cancer cells from that same patient, and you sequence those cancer cells, and you just look along the genome, and you see where there are differences. So these are not hypothecated differences. They're not suspected differences. They're differences that are actually picked up by genomic sequencing. And when you look at a whole variety of different sorts of cancers, what you see is that there are some cancers that have very, very high rates of mutation, but they all have mutations. Some of those that have the highest rates are cancers that are known as melanomas, skin cancers that one usually develops from an overexposure to sun, the sun causing mutations. Jimmy Carter's melanoma was probably caused when he was walking through his peanut fields out there in those long sunny Georgia days, the sun causing a number of mutations, that some of which perhaps led to the melanoma that he contracted. So, one gets cancer because genes undergo mutations. Many of those genes that undergo mutations are proto-oncogenes that transform into oncogenes. One can now actually take those tumors and sequence them and determine the mutational landscape present in those tumors. And when one does that sequencing, one finds that a number of those genes will be some kind of mutation that supports a tumor. But the majority of them, as a rule, they're just passenger mutations. These are random occurrences that take place. They don't have any obvious biological consequence in terms of the fate of the tumor. They are just along for the ride. The ones that are pushing the tumor are known as driver mutations. They're the dangerous ones. The ones that are along just for the ride, well, they're just there. But as we go on and look a little more deeply into immunotherapy, we're going to find that they may play, in some cases, a salvational role. Now, if you look at the immune system, here's what the immune system does. The immune system is very, very good at distinguishing self from non-self, because the microbes that infect us represent non-self. The immune system can recognize those and attack the non-self and resolve infections. However, the immune system can also recognize changes in normal structures that are present in the body, the proteins that are present in our body. If we get a mutation in some of those proteins, it causes a change in the structure. The immune system can recognize that and can react against it. I just said that one of the hallmarks of cancer is that cancer develops with a lot of mutations. Some of those mutations cause changes in protein structure. Some of those changes in protein structure will be recognized as non-self, as altered self, rather, by the immune system, and will be able to bring down an immune attack on cells that are displaying those aberrant proteins. So, in fact, what's been found is that the immune system does, in fact, recognize cancerous cells, and you do, in fact, mount an immune response to cancerous cells. Now, the immune response is terribly complicated, as this slide will tell you, and I'm not going to teach the whole immunology course that we usually take a semester to do here at Amherst College in the next 3 or 4 minutes. Wouldn't be much point in doing that. But the idea is it's complicated. There are a lot of different kinds of cells involved. Key cell actors are cells known as T cells. And some of the T cells that are involved, the so-called CD8 T cells up there at the top, these are killer T cells. When they recognize cells that have a particular kind of antigen displayed for them, what those killer T cells will do is to attack that cell and cause its death. And one of the things that immunotherapy wants to do is to develop large populations of those killer T cells that will see the cancer cells and kill them. In the course of making that immune response, one also stimulates populations of cells known as B cells that will make antibodies, and some of those antibodies are specific for the cancer cells. Probably in the body, those antibodies haven't been terribly critical in removing and protecting us against the cancer. In the hands of the oncologist, in the hands of the pharmaceutical companies, particular antibodies that can recognize cancer cells are types of cells that will be cancerous and ignore all other cells have turned out to be extremely valuable to deliver focused attacks on the cancer cells that don't attack so much of the normal cell populations. So we're going to find that those antibodies are very important, agents of immunotherapies too, and in the next slide, in a rather surprising way, we're going to find they're important. Look, the immune system is biological dynamite. Get an overactive immune system and you have autoimmunity. The immune reactions have to be kept under the tightest biological control. You've got to have just enough. You can't have too much. You've got to get to the Goldilocks condition. So built into immunophysiology are a number of braking devices. There are a number of checkpoints in immune responses where you can slow down or halt an immune response. That's wonderful. It turns out to be a handicap when you want the immune response to be an extremely vigorous one against a tumor. And what we find is that in the induction of an immune response, when you're first triggering one, there is an important checkpoint mediated by a molecule called CTLA-4 that's shown up here. And what that checkpoint does is to make sure the immune system doesn't become hyperactivated. A valuable checkpoint. Without it, you'll get illness. You'll get autoimmunity. You'll get the immune system attacking the body itself. Once the immune response gets started and it's out there in the tissues mediating defenses against an infection, you want the response to eventually turn down because you'll get too much inflammation and you'll get all sorts of inflammatory disease. And so you want to slow that immune response down and eventually bring it to a close. And there you have another molecule called PD-1, which is present on the T cell. And when that's engaged by molecules in the environment where the immune response is taking place, that tends to negatively regulate the immune response too. So that's another checkpoint. So you've got a checkpoint where you induce the immune response. You've got a checkpoint, and actually more than one checkpoint. You have a number of them. You have a number of checkpoint mechanisms that take effect where the immune responses are taking place. You don't want checkpoints when you're reacting against cancer. You want to go out full bore. And so what people realize, particularly Jim Allison was the first person to point this out at MD Anderson Hospital, if you get antibodies that block the action of CTLA-4, you now get a more vigorous activation process taking place. If you take antibodies that block the interaction of this ligand, this molecule that can interact with PD-1, which will slow down immune responses in the peripheral tissue, those immune responses will go at a greater rate. So that's the basis for what people are talking about when they talk about checkpoint inhibitors, the new rage in terms of treatment of cancer. Fortunately, these have worked better than many other things have worked for melanoma. Still, perhaps only about 25 to 35% of patients treated might have enduring responses. But in many cases, those were patients who would have had nowhere to turn without this particular approach. Probably the most notable responder is Jimmy Carter, who had tried everything possible for his melanoma, had run out of options. The tumor had reached his brain, as you know. He was treated with a checkpoint inhibitor that blocked the action of PD-1 and slowing down the immune response. And Jimmy Carter is now around giving speeches and being the great man that he's always been. So that's one of the triumphs of immunotherapy, but it's very much at the beginning, and one can expect a number of new developments. If you looked at that last slide that showed the immune response, what you see is it's very complicated. Some kind of receptor has to recognize an antigen from a cancer cell. Then you have to have elaborate signaling processes take place, which finally end up kicking a killer T cell into action so it can attack a cancer cell. What molecular biologists have done is to eliminate a lot of the middlemen that are involved in mounting this response. What they have done is to take an antigen binding domain from an antibody that can recognize antigens that are present on particular types of tumor cells, the most successful approach being B lymphomas, because they always have a molecule called CD20 on their surface. So they take the binding site from antibodies for CD20, and using the techniques of recombinant DNA technology, they use a kind of molecular biological surgery, if you will, to join that to signaling domains in molecules that can actually stimulate T cell responses by these killer T cells. And they introduce these constructs into T cells so that when those T cells encounter in the body a cell bearing one of these tumor antigens, the T cell will be triggered without any of that folderol that we showed on the earlier slide having to take place. The T cell will be directly triggered to kill the cancer cell. And that's called a chimeric antigen receptor T cell, because you have put together this molecular chimera that has the antigen recognition domain, the signaling domains that are necessary to trigger the response of the T cell. And it kind of reminds you of the chimeras you learned about if you took some of the classics courses that were offered here at Amherst College. This is a very ugly development here. This is a beautiful advance, if you will, in cancer therapy. There's still another approach that's been used that uses a kind of, again, cell biological jujitsu to turn the normal biology of cancer against itself. When we get cancer, our immune systems recognize it, and we get an immune response. It's not a strong enough immune response, but we get an immune response. Steve Rosenberg and his colleagues at the NIH have pioneered a technology that involves isolating anti-cancer T cells from the body, growing those T cells outside the body, and then reinfusing the patients with them. What they do is they take a sample of the tumor, they sequence the DNA in that tumor, determining what mutations are present in the tumor. They then use the techniques of molecular biology to build synthetic mini-genes, if you will, that incorporate those mutations. They introduce those mini-genes into cells that can present the antigen to T cells, which they have taken from the patient. The patient has some T cells that will recognize cancer cells bearing those mutations in the body, there just aren't enough of them, or they aren't active enough. They take that whole population of T cells from the patient. They, in the laboratory, they stimulate it with cells that are displaying these cancer-relevant antigens from the patient. Those T cells that can recognize those cancer-relevant agents are stimulated to expand their numbers a great deal. So you might start with a few million cells and grow in the laboratory 100 billion cells that can recognize the tumor. And then you infuse those back into the patient. They course all through the body, just like chemotherapy might do. And they attack the cancer, and you get results such as those shown on this slide. This woman, Melina Bacini, she had run out all of her options. She had a very, very rare type of carcinoma, a cholangial carcinoma, and there was nothing that could be done. She was taken on an experimental therapy basis by the Rosenberg Laboratory. They used this adoptive T-cell transfer therapy in her case, and this is her 8 years after the procedure. Here is Celine Ryan, an engineer, a mother of five. She had metastatic colorectal cancer, a person, again, who had run out of options. The Rosenberg Lab took her on as a patient, and Dr. Tran led a group that used the approach that I just mentioned, this adoptive T-cell transfer therapy, and here she is, obviously flourishing. So we are at the beginning of a number of new technologies that are going to be extremely important in cancer therapy. Unfortunately, at this early stage, things haven't progressed to a level where they can be universally applied to all cancers. It's kind of idiosyncratic which tumors are going to respond. And a great deal of effort is being devoted to identifying those members of patient communities that are likely to benefit from these particular therapies. And some progress has been made there, but much more needs to be made. The good news is, I've only had time this morning to present a couple of many, many, many cancer therapies. And I can't get back to the original slide, Pete, but I'm not going to worry about that. But there was a slide that showed perhaps 10 other immunotherapy approaches that have gotten through successful clinical trials now that people are actually beginning to use in the clinic. So we come to the end of the beginning. We can expect a great deal more. My advice is, don't do what I did. Wait another 10 years before you get cancer. But if you've done what I've done, there are going to be more and more options. Just hang around and be able to take advantage of them. Okay. As usual, I've gone over.
Strong immune response that will act systemically against the tumor. That has still hope for.
It's really just the virus.
I'm sorry.
It's really just the virus that's attacking the tumor then?
It's the virus attacking the tumor, yes. And it's not a polio virus that's used, it's a monkeypox virus. Other questions here?
Yes, for early detection, when Reed actually was popular press about being able to detect a single solid cancer cell floating by in the bloodstream. Is that realistic?
There is good news on early detection. Because
Repeat the question.
Sure. The question was, are there methods of early detection for cancer? You're hearing in the news that people can actually take cells out of the bloodstream and detect cancer that way. And the question was, is that really true? The answer is, yes, it's true, and there's more. One can now detect something called circulating tumor cells in the body and can detect it for a number of different kinds of cancer. It's not in a routine diagnostic mode yet, but that's the way a lot of people like to take it. An even more sensitive way to do it is to look for circulating tumor DNA in the bloodstream, which people are finding, and it's the basis of blood tests that people are starting to do now to pick up certain kinds of cancer. There is a stool test one can do for colorectal cancer that looks for the presence of oncogenes that will be diagnostic for cancer such as colorectal cancer. Those are being sold now under the label of Cologuard. So the era of earlier detection is here. It's molecularly and cellularly based, and it's going to become more and more widespread. Again, we're at the beginning. You're going to see a lot more taking place. And that's very good news. Other questions, please.
Early on in your talk, you showed about how you have first one mutation, and then a couple of mutations, and then lots of mutations. My question is, does having one mutation then lead to having more, or is it just a matter of accident, whether they happen to be more or not?
Right. As a rule, the development of cancer is going to require a series of unfortunate events, those unfortunate events being a chain of mutations. Usually just one mutation, with the occurrence of one oncogene, you usually need 3, 4, 5 of these events to take place. Different oncogenes, and that's some genes called tumor suppressor genes, usually go south as well. So you need a constellation of unfortunate accidents to take place all in the same line of cells in order to get cancer into the body. It's hard to develop cancer because the odds are very much against it. But for God's sakes, we've got 13 trillion cells in the body. And so we've got a lot of bingo boards.
Time for one more.
I'm sorry.
Please. Time for one more question.
Yes.
Just
time for one more question, please. Right there.
Thank you. What does this area of inquiry tell us, if anything, about the future of primary prevention of cancers as opposed to early detection or secondary prevention?
Primary prevention of cancer can take two ways. One is behavioral. Don't smoke. Be somewhat careful about the things we know that we don't. We're not quite sure exactly how you be precisely careful about this, but we know it has a role. But things like smoking, things like exposure to carcinogens, we know about that. And second, there are at least two vaccines around that will prevent cancer. The HPV vaccine prevents cervical cancer. Essentially, all the cervical cancer we have caused by HPV, thank God for an Amherst graduate named Doug Loewy, who is one of the main people responsible for the development of HPV vaccine. And also hepatitis B causes liver cancer because it causes an infection in the liver that causes rampant inflammation, causing some cells to develop into tumor cells in the liver. So we've got two vaccines that can be used to prevent cancer. People are wondering about vaccines against Helicobacter pylori to use those to prevent some kinds of stomach cancer. But we'll see if that actually works out. I
I've had to talk like a tobacco engineer, or a tobacco auctioneer on the radio here. Some of you are actually old enough to be in the audience and remember this guy who would auction off Lucky Strike. That was me in another life.